Hello and welcome to Nakama Britannica, the only podcast whose chief director is Akiyuki Shimbo. This time we're going to be dissecting SLA, Scotland Loves Anime, 2017, going through as many of the films as we can remember in our drug-induced stupor. Now, this time it's just the two of us. Once again, I am Professor Irony, and I should be viewed from the side because viewing me from the bottom would just be odd. With me is...
I'm Arbalest, and I record my podcast while running a motorcycle in slow motion.
I feel like that should involve some kind of a montage, but I don't know. It's just the way it's
going. We can include that on YouTube if we want to. You know, I think that would work.
Yeah, just you know, some kind of like speed trails coming up behind you.
Multi-track drifting in the background, you'd be fine.
Oh God, yes. There. But yeah, it was quite a diverse run of films that we got this year. I think there was a good selection. I remember last year, I don't think I went to very much, but this year there was, if anything, too much to get to. I didn't manage to get to as many of the things as I wanted to, which is, you know, beginning with a complaint.
Yeah, there was quite a lot. I mean, last year you had, I think the focus was on, I would say, Kizumonogatari, parts 1 and 2. You had Silent Voice and you had Your Name, which were massive successes at the time. This year, they even kind of said there's a lot more you'd be interested in seeing, but there wasn't as many hard hits or like massive films this time around to kind of work your way into. But it was very diverse. There was a lot more variety, I think, this time around, whereas last year there was more almost a regular theme going across the board.
Mm. Nice to see a lot of older films playing this year as well. I mean, I think there have been comments from people saying, you know, it would be nice to get more older films into the festival, and that seems to have filtered through.
Yeah, I think, I know certainly from previous years, Andrew always kind of expressed getting at least one classic in a year, and this year they were more than able to do that. They got three, well, if you count, I don't know if you count Venus Wars as a classic, but, you know, you do have three. You've got Tokyo Godfathers, you had Venus Wars, and you had Metropolis as part of the lineup for this year. So there was a good set of older films to match the newer films as well.
I mean, in a way, I suppose you could almost count Mind Game in with those as well. I think it was 2004 that came out, apparently. So.
Oh, was it that long ago?
Yeah,
actually, I had it in my head that was a lot sooner than that for some reason.
I thought
so.
It was newer as well. I don't know. Strange business. Strange film. But, I mean, you were mentioning Metropolis there as well, so, I mean, perhaps we should just get straight into it, and I didn't manage to get to this one because it was the last slot in Edinburgh, and I had a train to catch, but, you went to this one, man. How did you find it?
I actually really enjoyed it. It's a bit of a slow start, I would say, for a film, but it is really good. I think what I was... enjoyed the most of the film was the fact that it felt like I was taking a blast back into the 1950s kind of ideology of what the future would look like with robots. To kind of match that, the soundtrack and the art stylings, and I think just the way the animation was done, very much incorporated that kind of idea. That was really well done, for especially considering that I was a bit surprised at first hearing that the film was only 2001, I think it was.
Yeah. So. I actually thought this was a slightly newer film than that. I was surprised at that. I'm just trying to think about, you know, how to distill down the plot of Metropolis into, you know, one or two sentences. It's not that easy. I mean, I guess you just say it's about a Japanese detective and his nephew that come to this sort of retro-futuristic European city. I don't think they ever state what the date that the film takes place is. To search for a criminal doctor, I think it is, but find themselves kind of caught up in a larger, you know, larger events heading towards a kind of revolution that might overthrow the corrupt and uneven societal hierarchy, I suppose you would say.
I think that kind of fits, actually.
Before I saw the film, I always thought that this was going to have a lot more in common with the classic sci-fi, the classic silent sci-fi film that it shares its name with, but it doesn't really. I think the anime version at least takes a few kind of thematical elements about it, and it's this kind of slightly dystopian, you know, retro vision of the future where there's a kind of a very distinct class hierarchy, and it's about a kind of robotic figurehead for a revolution to shake things up in that. Although the anime version also places a lot of emphasis on a detective and his nephew, I think it is, who come to investigate
They come over from Japan
Yeah.
to investigate this doctor who's creating, who's the other main character of the film. I forgot his name, Tima, that was it,
Oh yeah,
Tima.
yeah.
And they're trying to catch him because he's got a warrant for his arrest in Japan, so they're there to kind of pick him up and take him back. But things don't go as planned, they never do. But it's more about kind of that, almost like they're the kind of viewing how this metropolis kind of views their hierarchy, as you said, therefore robots and people alike, because they're all kind of fit between that. Whilst all the robots are all kind of designated, you know, zone 1, 2, and 3, and they're never allowed to leave those designation areas. In some cases, some of the people are kind of similar as well. They're kind of allocated zone 1 or the top zone, and you kind of get that discrepancy between the two, and there's a lot of civil unrest between it, which you get a lot of the time. But I think the robots were kind of, they were trying to capture the old equality kind of message in there. It's something I think that's been done a lot, and Tezuka's not probably. I think that's where I got a lot of feelings from that, come from similarities to, I guess, stuff like Astro Boy, where, you know, there's the robots and human kind of thing. So it's kind of like that's where I got the similar feelings from.
Yeah, I think there's a lot about the relationship between robots and their creators, I think, which is something I think you get with Astro Boy as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of that mishmash, and I think with this one it was more the idea of Tima, who didn't think she was a robot at any point in time, kind of determines the idea, and trying to it kind of brings in the question of what right do we have to say when it gets to that point, calling us one or the other, why can't we live in harmony kind of thing. And that's where things then go out of control and become your kind of atypical sci-fi film, is what you expect. It's still done very well. It is a bit of a slow start, but it's enjoyable throughout. I think the soundtrack really does its injustice because it captures the kind of era that it was maybe trying to portray itself as being, as I say, 1950s portrayal of the late 2000s, early 2000s of what that may look like.
Yeah, I mean it's yeah, the visuals of the film, I think you really couldn't fault. I think it's also a particularly nice example of Tezuka's manga in anime form. I think, you know, some of the adaptations of Tezuka's work, it doesn't always seem to transfer that well to anime, but I think they really kind of caught it well for this one. It's a very good looking film, and I mean it's sort of thing I
Is.
imagine would look great on a big screen if you could see it that way.
Yeah, I think the one thing that wasn't noted with it as well is this film was shown in 35mm.
Oh, nice. Right, yeah.
So they were really proud of actually getting that done. So, and I
Yeah,
think that
yeah.
really helped. It just kind of added that kind of crisp classic feel to it, which is really nice.
So it seems appropriate for that film as well, I would say.
It really was, and I think it was great that they actually got it for that film. Some people weren't too keen on it being the last film. I thought it was a nice way to end, so it was a good film, honestly, I think.
Yeah, if it hadn't been in that last slot, I would have quite happily gone to that one. But yeah, I mean, I guess if we don't have anything further to add about robot figureheads, we can go to a very different kind of figurehead. A figurehead on a motorcycle, should we say?
Yes. This is the first from I saw. I should note before we cover this is going to be Resident Evil Vendetta,
Yeah, I was
but
going to say, we should probably tell people
we
what
should
the
mention
film
that's
is
what it is.
now.
So if be prepared, this is going to be kind of a bit of a laugh. But before that, there was three other films shown as well. I didn't see them, but they were showing the dubbed versions of Your Name and A Silent Voice. A Silent Voice was going to capture my interest, but we didn't see it in the end, because the dub does include the deaf voice actor,
Yeah, I
who
was
I
gonna
was
say, I
really
didn't
interested to
know
see
that.
because I really love the fact they actually did that, and I want to see how well that comes across. The third film, which I didn't see because I've seen it again quite a few times, is the first Resident Evil CG film, Degeneration. That's not too bad. It's just a very cheesy Resident Evil atypical film, is what you expect. Vendetta, on the other hand, is is bad. It's bad. But it's also good, because it's extremely entertaining. You know, if you don't know the film itself, this was the recent release of a CG film for Resident Evil that was covering everyone's favourites, Chris Redfield, Leon Kennedy, and my favourite, who I feel was really badly portrayed in the film, Rebecca Chambers.
This is just Barry Gordon.
No Barry Burton this time around, no. So there's no references to Jill Sandwiches.
Damn.
There's no references to This Is My Gun or anything like that. I am really sorry. So if you're looking for that kind of cheese, it's not there. But there is another level of cheese, and it's action. If you want the general plot of the film, bad guy takes over reins of Neo Umbrella. He's really evil. He has the way to control zombies and actually make them recognize friend from foe. Chris goes out to go deal with him. He's there to go and try and save someone. Fails, encounters a bad guy. The person he was trying to save was turned into a zombie. Chris was about defeated, but was saved by his partners. And just to make sure there's enough drama before the film goes to its title card, it goes and has Chris pick up the dead zombie of the person she was trying to save, and shouting no at the top of his voice, with the entire building in the background, which funnily enough looks like every mansion in Resident Evil, going into flames at the same time. If that's not enough cheese for you, the entire film consists of Leon in slow motion, and I wish to say it was almost every scene he was in, but it's close enough to it. Chris being the level-headed, the kind of like aggressive one, but seems to be a flip side of what they were like in Resident Evil 6. Chris was the drunk. Leon was the one trying to push him back. It's the other way around. And then Rebecca Chambers is there as the doctor who's got the cure, trying to solve the virus issue again. And she eventually plays a damsel in distress, which I find really frustrating because she's not.
Yeah, she was like one of the main heroes in Zero.
She was the protagonist alongside Billy Cohen in Resident Evil Zero, and also she actually saved Chris in Resident Evil as well, because Chris gets infected and but she's not exactly a weakling, so the fact that she was kind of portrayed slightly as such really annoys me. But from that point on, hilarity ensues. I haven't figured out why Leon is the poster boy of Resident Evil.
He has nice hair.
That too. He hasn't got his coat from Resident Evil 4 though, so I'm really disappointed about that. He's not really done very well at the beginning of the film. When you actually get introduced to Leon, he's basically a drunk. And he's like, he's all kind of wallowing in his own despair.
I don't know why that amuses me. It's just, I don't know. I never had him down to be kind of angry, embittered ex-cop, you know, hit the bottle type somehow.
Yeah, well, they expect that.
It seems more like that would be fitting for Barry somehow. Never mind.
There's no real horror in the film. You get one moment where you say, oh, that could potentially be a horror.
Yeah.
And then you realise that the director who's made this film apparently is a horror director, but to me just comes across as very much an action director.
Mm-hmm.
And every scene that Leon's in is ridiculous. Case in point. So they have no sense of caring about the general public as well. So at one point in the film, Leon is driving down a motorway with two zombie dogs chasing him at the same pace the bike's going. He takes out one of the dogs, which stumbles back into two cars, so it somehow knocks the cars back on top of each other and explodes. So these two gentle passers-by suddenly go in flames. The next one that goes by...
It's okay, you can see their parachutes.
Yeah, the next one that goes by, he shoots, and then he shoots the sign above it down onto it to make sure it's dead, but that's not enough. He then decides to grab a grenade and throws it behind him, and kills the dog with the grenade explosion, whilst going away from it in slow motion. And from this point on, nine out of ten scenes you see Leon in where there's action involved, he's in slow motion. So from this point on, Leon looks flamboyant in the sky whilst on the motorcycle, which makes it through the entire film, including going up to the top of a skyscraper building, and actually takes out, you know, and uses that to fight against the big bad, which you'll find out is just some other giant monster thing again. So it's very cool Resident Evil. It's very bad in the way it's done, but it's extremely entertaining in the way it's done as well.
Fair enough. How was the CG just generally? I mean, does it look okay or?
Yes, it does. Clemens actually made a point to mention it that as well, that the studio who does this, I think Sega own them, but basically he made a point that a lot of people when it comes to CG and animation can only work with one light source. These guys have a massive budget, so to show off, they have multiple light sources going off at once. That's so many torches to see that. They also have proper collision with the ground and the characters walking. And they're able to even have a full-on fist fight going through in the CG as well at the same time, and it all looked really well done. So, whilst there is a lot of flaws with the story and the action and so on and so forth, and there is a lot, the CG itself is very nice to look at. So, at the very least, you're getting something fairly pretty to watch.
It's just a shame that the writing wasn't better by the sounds of things.
Yeah, I'm being honest, Resident Evil's never had the best of writing. It had decent story in some ways, but it never had the best of writing. This one just feels like it's going the wrong direction because Resident Evil at least had its cheese. But this film didn't really have that same Resident Evil cheese as you'd expect. And I think that's where the problem lies.
Oh well, from one slice of cheese, perhaps we should move on to another, in that I believe you've got a fair bit to say about Eureka 7, the high evolution movie for number one.
Yes, I wouldn't say this is cheese. I think this is just sheer disappointment, to be honest. For those that don't know, Eureka 7 was a 50-episode series released going on 13 years now, 12, 13 years. It was a really popular time, girl mecha show.
Alien robots and surfing in the sky.
They said, we're going to do a revamp, we're going to release three films capturing the series again. And also, the director, I will advise as well, we were told, viewed this film as something you can watch blind. Now, I disagree entirely. My girlfriend came to join us watching the film. Oh, that's great. We're going to watch the film and see what it's like. I was telling her, you need to watch it first, and I was told, no, you don't. So she just went in blind. And she came out saying, what the hell did I watch? So, it's a film of two parts. One 30-minute bit, and then the rest, which I hope didn't exist, but does. The first 30 minutes capture what's called the Summer of Love. It's the prequel to the entire story of what happens. Something that's never covered in the series, and it's a half an hour of covering what that event is, how it's come to play out, and how essentially the rest of the story comes to play out, and why Renton and everyone else is involved, and who Eureka is, and who Renton's father is, for example. And this first half an hour is done really, really well. It's a really good half an hour. You get a good idea of the world it's in. That's great. I wish it was just an OVA though, because when you move into the main bulk of the film, they mess it up so badly. I just don't understand why. So what they've done is they cover the prequel, that's fine, and then they flash forward to Renton running away from a whole bunch of dogs, which doesn't take place until episode 34. So they miss the entirety of the start of the series, how he Renton meets Eureka and Holland and everyone else. Misses the how he leaves them in a huff, well, not entirely, but to the point for most of it, and starts from meeting with Ray and Charles, who are adoptive family, and it focuses on them and Renton. Their way of telling the story about him and why he's there and what's going on is by doing this play forward and play back idea, whereby they will start from a point in time and say, so I'll need to go back first and tell you about this. So they'll go back. We'll go play back 8 hours. So to tell you how I got to this point. And it's just a diabolical mess, honestly. I really want to say, this is good. This is good. And I really want to go out in there and say, you can watch this and feel proud of watching Eureka 7. And I just came out saying, I'm so sorry. It's like, why didn't you come and watch that with me? It goes play back, play forward, play back, play forward, and at one point in the film, you're kind of left wondering at what point have they played back to? Is it playing back to this point? And then it's gone played forward again by another 4 hours, and you're thinking, oh, so is that 4 hours from the beginning of the film, or the point when we saw Renton? Is that 4 hours from what we just saw now? Where is it? And your head kind of just explodes slowly as you go through this idea of where the hell am I in the story now? I did learn afterwards that there's a lot of it that's been done deliberately. It's not going to affect how I view the film. I still think it's an utter mess. But apparently some of it is deliberate, because apparently they're going to do something else. But I don't know what, whether there's some kind of ulterior motive with the next film and they're going to make some kind of masterpiece. I don't know. We were always told to go on expecting something like Eva. Mm. Eva 1.1, even yeah. 2.2.
Yeah.
Going by this alone, it feels like all we've done is just throw a whole bunch of scenes together and hope for the best.
And was there a lot of actual new content to it? I mean, did it bring anything new into the story that wasn't there in the series? Or
out with the first half an hour? No, not at all. There was maybe some slight changes and deviances here and there, but not much. There could be a lot different going forward in the second film, but I don't know. If there was anything good to be said for it, again, the first half an hour is really nice. It is really well done. The other thing that's good was that they were able to keep the music the same from the series. If you're not really well versed with Eureka 7, there's a lot of focus on music and how important that is in that world, but it's not enough to kind of make up for the mess that the film actually is. The kicker was the preview you have for the second film completely goes against the idea of the rest of the film you saw. The tone don't match up. So the first film's quite serious in its tone. It's quite almost... I'm guessing they're trying to go with the idea of Rent and kind of figuring out who he is and where he deserves to be. The second preview basically seems like it's going for some kind of idol cheerleading thing with football in the background. I'm not joking. It feels like you're going from one extreme to another, and you don't even know where that's coming in and how you even get to that point. From the end of what I saw, you're essentially getting half an hour of new content, followed by five episodes of the middle of the season, and nothing else. And even then, it doesn't make enough sense. So there's not enough there to make sense of what's going on. If you're going to watch this, if you are going to go through that slog, please watch it after watching the series. If you're going in blind, you're a fool. I'm sorry to say, you are a fool. And I feel sorry for telling people you can watch it before that, because you really can't.
Interesting, but unfortunate. I take it you were saying that you'd written a kind of long-form review of this for the site as well, so...
In the process of doing so, it's not finalized just yet, but that should be up soon. Sure. Probably might be up before this goes up. So if you have,
I was gonna say, probably by the time we get the podcast up, that will be available. So
You'll probably be able to read my rant in words there as well. So if you want a double dosage, please read. Please don't watch the film if you can. Well, yeah, if you do watch the film, please at least go in expecting the worst, because after the first half an hour at least.
You've only got yourself to blame.
Yeah, you really do.
As I said before, I was greatly disappointed that it wasn't a better film, so that all you would have needed to say was Eureka 7 out of 10, job done.
Yeah, I know, I really wish I could have done. But,
someday.
Someday it'll happen, maybe the third film. Maybe the third one that I can actually say, yeah, there we go, Eureka 7 out of 10.
Suddenly it all makes sense. I guess we should probably move on, think about what else is on our list, and I was going through some of the films there, and I'd actually forgotten that one of the things that showed in Glasgow was The Dragon Dentist, which I don't think was on in Edinburgh.
It wasn't, no. We never actually got that here.
Yeah. So I remember watching a bit of the TV special that came out from that. I believe this was actually one that was spawned from the Japan Animator Expo, kind of interesting sort of fantasy piece about supernatural dentists, for want of a better explanation. It's got a slightly kind of wuxia martial arts kind of thing about it. I don't know, maybe it's just the idea of attending to these giant dragon beasts that, are kind of in this almost sort of limbo-like, slightly purgatorial fantasy world. There's something about that makes me think of the kind of tradition of Chinese fantasy films. I don't know why that, it's maybe just the kind of Journey to the West thing that kind of makes me think of that. But I must admit, I did not get...
I think, yeah.
As I watched a bit of the TV special, I quite liked it, but I can't remember why I didn't go to this. I guess I just had something else to do that day.
I completely actually blinded that I was on there. I guess because we weren't really intending going to the Glasgow event at the same time, because get the week off. I just completely glanced over it. I think Glasgow's actual lineup came out later than Edinburgh as well. So I think once I seen Edinburgh, I just kind of focused on that than anything else.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was sure that there was something that did show in Glasgow that wasn't on in Edinburgh, and apparently, yeah, it was this that was that particular title. I actually thought it was the live-action version of Tokyo Ghoul, but I think that was on in both Glasgow and Edinburgh, and neither of us can think of anyone who went to see it. So, yeah, good
no.
job.
I mean, I think I know one or two people from Twitter that went, but I think they went to literally everything, even if they hated it.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, good for you. Go for it. But
good job, guys.
I think moving on from there.
No, I mean, I'm sure people did go to Tokyo.
Yeah, if it was actually whilst I didn't go, I do know the Edinburgh one was more or less packed. So it wasn't exactly that I had no one going to view it. It's just that we had no one in our groups. Really went to see it.
It was probably it might be okay, you know, like leave us a comment or you know send us a message or something and say I was at Tokyo Ghoul and it was fantabulous or I don't know, find your own adjective to describe that one. yeah, I was slightly disappointed that as live action things go, they didn't get the live action JoJo film, which I think is possibly what was in my mind when the word fantabulous came to mind. But
I think
that well either though. So.
No, it wasn't picked up that well to the point that I think they're originally going to do like a series of them. I think that's not going to happen anymore. I think one film that could have worked well if it was live action with us would have been the Gintama film. I think that would have been picked up, and I would have been more inclined to go see that if that was the one showing instead of Tokyo Ghoul. But,
yeah, I would have given that a shot,
But again, you know, it was a late night showing as well, but again, I think Gintama has a bigger sway here. I think it's caught on a lot more than people expect. Tokyo Ghoul is probably a more easier, accessible film, or series, but it's just not my kind of thing, honestly. Yeah. It's not what I want to see. I have my fair share of flying heads in other shows and films, as it turns out, we'll mention later on.
Yes.
So.
Yes, that was an unexpected delight. But I suppose when we're talking about things that are in Tokyo, we should also mention Tokyo Godfathers, because I was surprised to hear you say that you'd never seen this one before.
I hadn't, no. This is the first time I had ever seen the film. And it was one of the last ones of Khan's works I haven't seen, so...
I've still never seen Millennium Actress. I feel like a worse person for not having done so.
I have that here as well, which I do need to watch, because it was only Millennium Actress and Tokyo Godfathers that I had seen. I had seen everything else that he's done. So the fact that I got to see this on the big screen, I think, was a bit of a joy, because I think... If this was in the running for film of the year, of the film of the festival, I think it could have easily taken it as well, because it was such a lovely film. For those that have not seen it, I can't say what rock you behind under. I mean, I was the same, so you know. But the film basically is about three homeless people who come across a child that's been essentially abandoned, and it's their trek and trying to find the mother and reunite them together. It's a comedy film done by Satoshi Kon, which is something you may not expect considering his previous works, but it really works well. The cast are a good amount of fun, and it's just a lovely film. It's a Christmas film as well, which is something
very unusual for anime to do. I mean, certainly, you know, like beyond the level of, oh hey, let's, you know, maybe put some of the characters into Santa hats for 5 minutes or something, but yeah, to get like a proper Christmas film in anime, I think this surely must be about the only one.
It is, yeah. I mean, this one was, from what we know, when this was done, there was only, I don't know if the population has increased much with it now, but it was done in a country with only 2 million Christians. The reception there was mixed, but the fact that even then, looking at that now, I think the film itself is really charming, even if you look beyond that. The whole Christmas thing is there in the background, and it's played to a bit. You know, God shining upon me, this baby is lucky, and they go into a massive amount of disasters, which somehow they miraculously escape from. But it's just a lovely, heartwarming film at the end of the day, and I think as Christmas films go, if you really want to rate them on what film you should watch on Christmas Day, I think this one does fit in there, because it really does give you that kind of nice feeling at the end of the film.
It's the best Christmas film since Die Hard, and you can put that in the box, guys.
I was trying not to say that, but everyone I spoke to said the exact same thing. I mean, I like Die Hard, but I for a while I never even looked at it as a Christmas film. But I guess it is, you know.
And strangely, I never actually thought of the theological kind of elements of the film as being all that significant. But I guess now that you mention it, it kind of is in a way. I mean, it provides a surprising amount of motivation for the characters. I would say it doesn't feel preachy or anything. You know, we should stress that. It is quite unusual to see that come in as a kind of motivation, as I say.
It is, yeah. There's a few bits in there which are, which may seem very, I guess, cliched in some ways. It's three characters and a baby. three characters and a baby. It's almost like, you know, every film you've seen ever. Mariama was at the screening for Tokyo Godfathers, mm-hmm. and when during their Q&A they said that three just felt right. Two, four would have seemed a bit off, but three just felt right for the film and the way they were doing it. And I kind of agree. I don't think anything more or less would have worked, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, it gives it a nice kind of group dynamic between the three of them, really. It's difficult to kind of picture it without, you know, any part of that trio. They do make up this kind of nice little family unit in a way. It's hard to imagine, you know, if it was just two of them on their own, it just wouldn't be the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a mismatched family at the end of the day. Mm. Funnily enough, one thing that was picked up on as well, there was a point in time where they encounter this Yakuza boss who's kind of stuck underneath a car. And in the background, you see a political poster, and that actually has Mariama's face on it.
Oh.
So it's like he's like... director cameo on it, yeah. Also, the funniest thing is Hannah's movements, the way she moves very kind of effeminately in that, was designed under how Satoshi Kon moved to design the character. So Satoshi Kon moved in that kind of flow to kind of capture the character movements for the film, and that's what they based it on. So it was that was quite something to hear, but it's quite good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if anyone else is listening who hasn't seen the film yet, again, can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, it is really good.
Yeah.
I don't think I would rate the film as highly as I do Perfect Blue. I think Perfect Blue has a specific spot in my heart that I don't think is ever going to leave. But as ways films go, you really can't go wrong with it. You really can't.
Definitely Con's most accessible film, if nothing else.
It is.
So what else have we still got to cover? I mean, I suppose we could, a weird addition after talking about a Christmas film, you know, we should also mention that Vampire Hunter D: Bloodlust got trotted out for this one in time for Halloween. But
it did, yeah. We're not going to really need to talk much about it. If you've listened to our previous podcast about Kawajiri, then we did a nice chat about that one.
We covered it quite extensively. It's just a really solid action film. It's got a lot of the Western about it,
As mentioned before, the film was one of the only films during the weekend that was dubbed, but that was because the film was designed. Well, I guess if you call it dub, that was designed with the English cast in mind first before the Japanese dub came in. But again, solid film and had a good showing as well, I think.
I mean, this is ahead of Anime Limited releasing the film again in the UK as well, I believe.
Correct. Whilst I wasn't at the showing, some people from the showing did say that they've announced they've got the rights for the film, which so that should be coming up for another release again. And likewise with Tokyo Ghoul, while we only glanced over it, they did mention they've got more theatrical screenings coming for the film as well. So there is more for both of those films on its way, if you've not seen either of them before. Or were interested in Tokyo Ghoul but couldn't get to the screening.
I'll be interested to see if Anime Limited's release for Bloodlust includes the Japanese audio, because I don't think... Certainly, the UK releases of the film, or release of the film, didn't have the Japanese audio before, and I don't think there's been a official US release that has had the Japanese audio either. So,
Discotech have it in America at the moment. I don't know what their release is like. It might be not too dissimilar to the Discotech release. I don't know. If Anime Limited have it, then... we could expect miracles or expect something maybe slightly different, so we might actually get it. It would be nice to actually give it a listen to.
It would be a nice addition. I've heard that the Japanese audio for it isn't amazing. Like, I think it's possibly just one of these things where the English cast is so perfectly chosen that it's difficult to imagine anyone else doing the roles other than possibly D himself. I think the actor who played D was a little flat from what I remember in the English.
Yeah, I mean, I know D himself is fairly flat in the first place, but I mean, I think there could have been a bit more life with it. Mind you, The Hand was very well cast.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Mike McShane is absolutely perfect as D. Yes. You couldn't ask for a better performance, really.
It's one of those films that if you were to see it, you're not doing wrong by watching it with English rather than Japanese. It's not like these other titles where you would say, oh, I prefer it to be Japanese. This one is really built for English and it does suit it.
Absolutely, yeah. In terms of the films that we may have more to say about, should we approach the elephant in the room, as it were, and say a little bit about Kizumonogatari III?
Yes, we should do. So, it's not. There might be slight spoilers if you've
We'll try and keep it without... It's funny to see this one, as it actually contains the fight that the series has been teasing since the first episode, like nearly a decade ago now. So in a way, it almost feels like we've kind of come full circle. And I don't know if there's much left of the Monogatari series that hasn't been adapted, but this almost feels like an end to it.
Yeah, it's like the end to the beginning we had so long ago, Kizumonogatari is the prequel to the entire Monogatari series. It was released later, and it just covers Araragi's storyline, how he became this kind of pseudo-vampire, goes from there, as well as how he knows Hanakawa. The story is never touched upon at all, I think, in the main Monogatari series.
I think it's sort of referred to in the passing, but it's not a major part of it, generally.
Yeah, the film very much stays and feels self-contained, so if you've not been interested in watching Baki Monogatari, you're not going to miss anything or anything at all by just watching this on its own. You really aren't.
Well, so as long as you watch the other two parts that precede this third part.
So long as you watch all three parts of Kizumonogatari, not just part three. If you watch part three, then you're a bit of a fool, but, you know, it is self-contained, it's worth watching on its own, even if you weren't interested, because I think it does enough different to the Monogatari series, while still being remaining true to it as well, that it's worth watching.
And it feels much more like an action film. I mean, this is very much about the fight that Araragi has to reassemble his vampiric master. His name, I will get horribly wrong, is Kiss Shot Areola Heart Under Blade, I think it was.
It is, yeah. I think we'll probably be best just calling her Kiss Shot for
this. Yes, we'll go with that.
Because if not, we're going to be like saying so much that most of the podcast recording will just be us saying her name. If you don't know Niso Isin, the author, he has a very good, bad, I don't know what kind of habit he has, of describing very edgy moments in his books. And such, Kizumonogatari also has that.
It's not so much that it's... Well, I guess you could say it is fan servicey, but it's one of those things that I feel it kind of has its cake and eats it a little bit, in that it is fan service, but it's also being a little bit clever about what it's delivering as fan service. It's not quite what you would expect, I think.
It really isn't, no. I mean, I don't know how it is in later series. It has a lot of fan service in there, but it never... At least from what we've seen so far, it doesn't feel too out of place for what it is. And that's not something I'd normally say quite lightly, because it's when fan service is, it's very hard to find it when it doesn't feel like it's just thrown in there. In this case, it feels like it was trying to kind of...
It's kind of integral. I mean, it's not to say that it's never gratuitous. I mean there are certainly shots in, I think, the first film that it does feel like, you know, really, guys, did we need that? But... It's not something that would ruin the experience. I think you need to have a certain amount of tolerance for fan service to make it through pretty much anything with the Monogatari name on it. But at the same time, it's not just there, I think, purely to titillate and offend. I mean, it's a little bit more self-aware than that, I would say.
It is, and it never at one point does it really feel that you're overloaded with it. It feels like it's there more of a. I almost want to kind of say it's there to kind of build on to a particular character's relationship in a very weird way to say that, but it's it feels almost like they're humouring each other rather than anything else.
Yeah.
Araragi's kind of the pervert anyways. He's not exactly... Yes. It's never really something you can hide.
Yeah.
There's one particular... The reason we're mentioning it is there's one scene in the film which I would say takes up about 10 minutes focusing on one particular thing. And that may seem extreme. Doesn't feel it when you're watching it. I kind of sat back and thought, was I really right in saying that when I after watching it? And the more I thought about it, the more I felt, this is actually okay. I'm not bothered about it at all. Yeah. It doesn't feel like it's imposing. It doesn't feel like it's out of place. It feels like it's where it should be in a show that's meant to be in for.
It's one of these things, it's a little bit like, you know, while you're watching it, it seems to make perfect sense. It's only when you think back afterwards, you think, actually, that was a bit lewd. But I don't know. I mean, it's the sort of series that deals with fetishized toothbrushing, and if that's the sort of thing that, if you're inherently offended by the thought of this, I think, you know, the Monogatari franchise is probably not for you. There is more to it than that. I mean, I think you definitely see Shaft's signature style coming through in this one, and to the point that I thought might have been a little overblown. It struck me as being a little bit self-indulgent in that I think they could possibly have pared it down. There's a lot of just scenes of the camera kind of gazing at the landscape, sort of noticing the little surreal qualities of it, which is fine, but at the same time, if I feel like if you took out a lot of that, there wouldn't actually be a lot of incident left in the film when you break it down. I mean, basically what I'm saying is I don't know how I feel about this being a three-film trilogy. I feel like maybe they could have found a better format for it. I'm not sure.
I think because the first two are shorter than this one. This one's 83 minutes long.
Mm.
The first two are significantly shorter. I think if they just maybe cut, say, another half an hour into both the first two films, they could probably have done it that way.
Yeah.
I understand why they've done it, the three films. It feels like they were aiming for a very particular conclusion, which is what's captured in this.
Yeah.
But you're right in saying that it feels like there's a lot of added kind of scenery and kind of, I guess, metaphorical imagery in there, which Shafter is so well known for doing, especially with Monogatari, that you almost feel that some of it could have been left out just to fill out everything else, just to kind of buffer two films rather than three. I guess also money is always to be considered, but at the same time I feel like it didn't take away my enjoyment of the film. I still think it was a really good conclusion. But I think that there was some things they could have maybe cut off and just put into two films instead of points. Definitely that's there. But you're right, I think otherwise you mentioned it as very much an action film. It does feel that.
Yeah, I mean, not that there's an awful lot of action in it, but, you know, when you do get the key action sequence in this, oh boy, they really push the envelope with that. You follow the previous two parts, and, you know, you have an idea of what's coming in the third one, but, you know, when it arrives, it's just, it will exceed your wildest expectations in every way.
The only thing I will say with it, and the only thing that I will say going forward with the action side of things, is I thought Berserk was the best for flying heads.
Yes.
Turns out it has been dismantled from its throne. If you wonder why I'm saying that, you'll just have to watch this and witness.
Yes, it's a truly indelible scene. It will live on in your memory, whether you want it to or not.
I think the scene, if you're not good with gore, is going to just... I think if you're... Actually, that's a good point, I think. If you're not that keen on gore, if you find it very hard to stomach, watch this and just imagine this every time you watch something gory, and you'll be fine. you will be fine, I guarantee it, because it's just one of those things that you feel there's a lot of seriousness to the scene. They somehow bring enough comedy into it that you can't take it that seriously. I don't know, it's very I think the only way you can describe it is very Monogatari.
Yes.
It just feels like something you would see in this show.
Yeah.
If it was placed anywhere else, I would question it. But with it being here, I just felt like I can roll with it.
Yeah.
But
this is what they were building towards, and they have certainly delivered on that one.
They really have. The Kizu Monogatari series of films is not scared of its ability to have a multitude of dismemberments. Please look forward to that if you've not seen anything yet, because it is a joy to watch.
As much as I'm saying I don't know that the three film format entirely works, the three parts do feel fairly distinctive. I mean, thinking back on it, I would say that the first part felt a little more horror oriented, and that it does a lot to kind of build up the atmosphere and the sort of surreal style of the Monogatari series. I mean, I think that it kind of it plays it for more of a horror effect. If you've never seen Monogatari before, one of the series' hallmarks is this almost stage-like construction, and it seems to take place in a world where there are no characters other than the main characters. There are no background characters or anything like that. And I think they really milk that for the horror effect in the first part. The second part struck me as more kind of comedically oriented. I don't know why, I just seem to remember that as being the funnier section of the film. I think it's, maybe there were more gags in it, or it's just the sort of character interactions in that one?
I think it was the character interactions. I mean, the second one had those the bulk of the action in it, and the interaction with Hanakawa as well.
Yeah.
And I think there was just, with Araragi learning what he can do and what and so on, it just starts coming out in comical effect, and that's where it really is, just comical in points.
The third film seemed a bit more melancholic by comparison. Again, Jonathan Clements was quoting the ANN review when he said that Kizu Monogatari ends in misery for everyone, which is maybe makes it sound a little more downbeat than it actually is, but it does feel a bit, maybe not darker, but there is a certain sadness about it, which seems like a slightly odd way to end it when you consider what comes after this in Bakemonogatari.
It is, yeah. I mean, the only thing you do start to realise, if you have, it's only something you'll notice when you have watched Bakemonogatari and the rest of it, is you do start to feel sorry for Hanakawa. I won't say as to why, but you kind of, you do start to feel sorry for her.
It really does feel like much of the film belongs to Hanakawa.
It does.
Yeah. It's kind of strange because, I mean, she doesn't have, like, necessarily all that much to do in, across the three films in the way that Kishot and Araragi do, but she's kind of the heart and soul of the whole thing, in a way.
She is. I think when you look at the rest of the Monogatari series, Araragi is the one that holds everything together. He's the one that finds a solution and resolves it. In this case, I think Hanakawa's taken Araragi's place in that. She's the one that really kind of brings things together and finds a solution, the grounding element to it all.
I mean, I suppose having covered one Shaft film, should we now move on to another one? Fireworks, should we view them from the side or from the bottom?
That is actually the name of the title.
Yes. Which is, Jonathan Clements referred to this as being the second worst anime title, which makes me think, what was the first one? What was the first one? Again, this was a slightly strange one to discuss. It's billed as being an Akiyuki Shimbo film, but I'm not sure if it was this one that Clements was referring to when he was talking about the role of the chief director not always being that much involved in the production of the film. Yeah,
I think it was this one itself. Yeah, I think you mentioned another one with one of the other ones we've got left to cover as well, but I think this was the main film you mentioned on.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a mainstream kind of effort for Shaft compared to a lot of their other things. It does feel like an attempt to kind of cash in on the success of Your Name, but they have gone a little bit different with it. It's just the story of a pair of, I think they're middle school students in this one, who have a bet with a classmate that, you know, she says she'll go out with whoever wins a swimming race, and then the film diverges to show what would happen had one of them won, or if the other one had won. And again, like you know, we were kind of saying before, I think it does recall a lot Mamoru Hosoda's film of the girl who leapt through time.
It does, yeah. Just the way that the what ifs are covered. When you look at The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, the what ifs are basically relived. She uses this ability to travel back in time to revisit something and change something. Fireworks, it follows kind of a similar vein, but it works slightly differently. It's very much a similar idea, but it's more a case of the character thinks, what if? And this thing starts to happen, they go back to that particular point where they said, what if? Or what if I won that race in the beginning? And then you see from that perspective. It's not a spoiler to really say that you get a lot of different endings for the film. It's still one long continuous film, but it's the way it's approached. You feel like you could see where one bit's ending, like one story has ended and then where another one starts.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like a visual novel adaptation almost, and you've got a certain sense of kind of
Yeah.
going through the story to one ending and then kind of going back to the save point, then playing through to get the next ending and so on.
It does, yeah. What I think also was noticeable with the film is that when there was that change of what if and something moved on to a different bit, there was at points, sometimes more subtly, sometimes more evident, an art change in some places. Not always clearly evident, it was small bits here and there. It still felt like a Shaft film in terms of animation, but there was points where it did change. So I think the idea was they were using that as a means to show when a scene's changing, so when you're going to a different point in time
Yeah,
or
kind
to
of slightly different perspective.
a different perspective of it all. They play it really well with the idea of fireworks as well. It's one of the, I think, the key things you should know with the film is that animators ask themselves this question, are fireworks flat or are they round? And that is, as silly as it sounds, that is essentially the bulk of the rest of the film. What are fireworks meant to be like? And there's this massive debate at one point where they're saying, is it flat or is it round? And it starts making you wonder, oh, what is it? Is it flat? Is it round? What is it? Clearly they're round, by the way, spoilers.
Of course.
The way the film's done is, it's fairly obvious in the way where the story's going, but it's quite clever with the dialogue they use and the way they make you understand as well, the characters understand what's actually going on. There's small sort of hints here and there in the animation, in terms of what you see in the background and what the character's picking up as well, that you just kind of pick up on yourself and you see, I think I see what's going on now. And it kind of all comes into place.
I mean, it's yeah. I kind of liked the way the film played out. I mean, it's not to suggest that I feel that this is a better film than The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, but I like
No.
that it seemed to handle the third act of it better than that. I felt that that film did. That my long-running problem with The Girl Who Leapt Through Time is that I think it kind of loses its way into the third act, and this film I thought landed the bit, the, you know, the last part of it better than it did. You know, maybe as I say, not I think a better film than that, or perhaps necessarily a hugely significant film. But I mean, it surprised me to hear that this didn't do very well in Japan, because I mean, even if it's not amazing or anything, I think it's quite a pleasant way to pass the time. I mean, it's a perfectly acceptable 90-minute movie, you know?
A lot of people going in and saying, oh, the film did really bad in Japan, it wasn't really that popular there in Japan. When I saw it, though, I was like, really? There's a lot to like in this film. Sure, it's not perfect, and it's definitely not perfect. I mean, I actually found the ending of the film to be really frustrating,
Yeah, the
but
very end is kind of strange.
the very, very end is really frustrating. You'll see what I mean by that, and maybe that's. I won't kind of spoil it what it reminds me of, actually, because I think that would be a bit of a spoiler of what actually happens. But for what the film does otherwise, in terms of the way it kind of follows the what ifs, the way that's done, and the way the world kind of works, I think the film's done really well, and I think it is deserving of a watch. I personally, whilst there was a lot of decent films at the festival this time, I actually felt Fireworks left a longer lasting impression with me than some of the other films that were there, and I think it's still kind of sticking to me as one of my favourite from the festival. And I think it's just the way that it was done more than anything else. And I think it really is deserving of a watch, and I don't think it's deserving of half the discredits it's been getting from Japan and everywhere else, because I really don't feel that's as evident here as they made it out to be.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly fine. It's not the best thing ever, but it's worth seeing, definitely. Moving on from fireworks, we had a UK premiere of a film that is 28 years old, so, you know, I hope no one was in a hurry for that one. It is, of course, Venus Wars, the adaptation of Yasuhiko I'm going to get this right one of these times. Yoshikazu Yasuhiko. The adaptation of Yoshikazu Yasuhiko's manga
He's the director of the film, isn't he, actually?
Yeah, but he did the manga as well.
Oh, he did the manga as well?
Yeah,
cool.
That's his own manga. The adaptation of Yoshikazu Yasuhiko's sci-fi epic about a young biker gang getting mixed up in an ongoing war between human colonists on Venus.
Yeah.
And that is exactly the synopsis that we came up with the first time, and in no way have we had to do several takes of that. I think the problem with Venus Wars is that from the time it came out, it was always going to be compared to that other huge sci-fi epic from the late 80s about biker gangs, and find itself a little wanting. Yeah, basically it's not Akira.
It's not, no. Mm. I felt sorry for it, because when it was introduced to us, it was a case of, this was started made in 87, they thought, oh, this is great, this would be a good adaptation, they'll love it because of the way sci-fi is at the moment. And then Akira released, and they were like, oh, so things have changed, what do we do? Just go with it, we'll release it. This is the first time I watched Venus Wars. I had heard of it before, I didn't know much about it. My first response when I watched the film was how very 80s it was.
Mm.
Both in how Japan loved their motorbikes in that time, which they do, and just in some ways how they viewed their sci-fi, because I think there was a very similar style of they went with sci-fi in that kind of that era, and it kind of shows here.
Yeah, I mean, I think Akira is kind of ageless, and I think it really raised the bar for not just, you know, the kind of visual effects that we saw in anime, but also the kind of theme and tone sort of storytelling that it was. Not to say that the storytelling in Akira is always completely successful, but I think it told a very different kind of story that was maybe something we hadn't necessarily seen much of before, you know, maybe at least outside of video animation, kind of blood and thunder type OVAs we're getting around that time. Akira, I think, took a little bit of that and made it more accessible for a mainstream audience, whereas Venus Wars seems to loop back to what's come before. It's more like Gundam or maybe even Megazone 2-3 in a kind of way.
They did a lot which was expected. I mean, at first I thought of it more as a going into it as a mecha kind of show because of what I had seen of some of the artwork in that at the time, which wasn't much. But it was good enough in some ways, in the way it captured just another, like a war again, very similar. I felt there was some elements I got from Gundam because both with the art style and just with the way the story was.
I was going to say, you've got that kind of story of the, you know, the disinterested young man being co-opted into someone else's war. I mean, he doesn't literally fall into a Gundam, but the main character hero, he goes through a kind of similar trajectory, I think.
It does, yeah, and I think it doesn't also help the fact that one of the characters in essentially what becomes like the rebel kind of group of this colony is also voiced by the same voice actor as Char. So you kind of immediately start to see some similarities with the way characters are together, and that with the way characters are in Gundam and a lot of other shows in that time. And maybe it's just because a lot of sci-fi shows had the same voice actors here and there. Maybe that's where the similarity was, but the style was so very similar to that of Gundam in some ways, with some of the formatting, the way the characters interacted. But at the same time, saying that, when I said it was very 80s, there's a lot of that I get from that which also feels like it's done to that level. There's a lot of level of 80s cheese in some of the scenes, with some of the characters kind of reacting together. At one point, there was meant to be a romantic moment with the main character, and this romantic moment just has him stuck in his underwear, which is rather funny, because it, you know, maybe then they wouldn't have viewed it as such, but now we just kind of get a bit of a laugh out of that kind of thing. So you get that level of cheese, but yeah,
it's still pretty entertaining. I mean, I think the this was the second time I've seen Venus Wars. I think I actually enjoyed it a little more this time through, maybe because my expectations for it had been kind of adjusted accordingly. I think the characterization is spread a little too thin for it. I mean, you've got the main character, Hiro, who is your kind of angry young man, biker, likes to, you know, resolve problems with his fists rather than trying to think things through in a logical way, which I think is kind of what you see more nowadays. I think he's kind of a one-note presence throughout the film, and I slightly struggle to think why, because there's a lot that kind of happens to him, but I don't know whether it's just that he doesn't seem to grow as a character from this somehow, or what. Not to dwell on that too much, though, because as I say, I think the action scenes in the film are really well handled, and it looks well on the big screen. I mean, I think you can hardly fault the way the film looks. It's not, you know, Neo Tokyo the way Akira is, but it's, for what it is, it kind of harks back a little bit to the sort of the kind of cover art of old pulp sci-fi novels of the, you know, some earlier times from the 70s and such. You've got the kind of dusty, earth-toned landscapes and the sort of barren wastelands and everything. And it all looks really good. It's, I think it just needed a bit more streamlining. I think there are possibly too many characters with kind of too little development between them.
I think the best example of that is actually later on in the film. You're kind of introduced to this very camp character at the time, and
that was a bit of a misstep, I think.
But he's kind of shown very late onto the film. You don't know much about him at all in that. But for some reason, Hiro has flashbacks of the character. Yeah. And we have no idea why, because you see him for a very short amount of time that you don't know who the character is, or even feel you're going to get any benefit of this, yet you're given this flashback of a character that no one knows, really. So, and you're like, well, does that really add to the film? Could we have had just maybe those 2-3 minutes removed, you know, 30 seconds, a minute taken away from that at all?
I don't know if it's partly lost in translation or what, but I think a lot of the dialogue in the film is a bit kind of on the nose, you know. It seems a bit too direct in a way. There's you know, maybe a bit much exposition or something. Again, I struggle to pin down exactly what it is, but it's, I don't know, just a lot of the things that people are coming out with feel like something that no one would ever say.
Yeah, a lot of it just doesn't seem to add up. Sometimes when Hiro's going on a rant, he just kind of says things you just wouldn't expect.
It's dialogue that serves the plot, but not the character.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like a lot of shows did that at that time, but it did feel a little bit off.
As I say, for all its problems, I still did really enjoy seeing the film again.
It was good fun.
And I think it does some interesting things thematically, if nothing else. A bit of meditation in there, the role of the media and wars. And it's got a little bit of the sort of thing that Ryosuke Takahashi would go on to explore and stuff like Flag. And
that's a point, actually.
I don't know that she's a wholly successful character, but, you know, I feel the journalist character they have in the film, Susan Summers, does seem to be, she's kind of interesting in that she's quite idealistic about what she's doing, but at the same time, she's hungry to get footage of the war. You see the joy spreading across her face when she's out there with her video cameras. The buildings are getting blown up around her, and, you know, like later on in the film, she has one of her cameras mounted onto one of the bikes as it's going into battle, so that they can get the first-hand footage of, you know, basically people being killed.
Yeah, it was just quite interesting, concerning that for once the way they've done it is that Earth is peaceful. There's no war in Earth anymore. Mm. But Venus, because it's a new colony, a new style, and just only fairly new to this populace that's got there, there's war again because it's early in its life cycle. And to Susan going over to Venus to learn about this, she doesn't know what war is, essentially. So she's kind of throwing herself and thinking, this is exciting, but it's not seen the after effects. And as you say, she's not really the main character, though a lot of the artwork for the films and that did show her as being as such. You kind of start to understand on her side of things just how terrifying war can be. It's not done very well in the way that's portrayed, but you do start to see that that's what kind of a message they were trying to explain as well with her.
I was pleased to see that this got such a large crowd when I went to see it. I was a little bit concerned with this being a kind of older film and one that's not necessarily that well remembered in the UK at least, that maybe it would have been just a small audience that would turn up for it. But there was a good turnout for this. I was pleased to see that.
It was a good turnout for us as well, actually.
Yeah.
There was a lot of people there, so it was good. A good all round, I think.
Yeah. Definitely the way to see it if you possibly can, to see it in the cinema as well, although I think that may be a little unlikely to be available further, unfortunately. But yeah,
Yeah.
hey ho.
It's worth watching, as you
Yeah.
say, if you get a chance to do so.
Unfortunately, no release from AL forthcoming, I believe, but I think there is
No.
a BD available from Discotheque, and yeah, if you're at all interested in the anime films of the 1980s, then it's definitely worth picking this one up.
It is, yeah. It is definitely worth watching.
I suppose on that note, we should maybe head towards the end game with this, with a pair of new offerings from Masaki Yuasa, probably one of the hottest directors working at the moment, and also a top
Yeah.
bloke, it has to be said. The first of the two being Night Is Short, a kind of not exactly sequel to the Tatami Galaxy, but more kind of companion piece. This is based on another novel from the same original author as the Tatami Galaxy, and it also reuses much of the same kind of visual style and, to an extent, possibly the same character designs. Certainly, you see familiar faces from the Tatami Galaxy pop up in different roles here, and crucially, of course, we have Johnny the Cowboy making a reappearance.
The film follows a young man trying to woo over his sweetheart that he's got. She never sees him as such. It's always coincidence. She goes out enjoying what the nightlife has for her, so basically what she can enjoy in the nightlife.
Yeah, she goes out on a night out with her friends to enjoy herself, and as he, or senpai as the film refers to all the way through, they're just referred to as senpai and kohai, that he tries to follow her and ingratiate herself into her group, but more or less ends up failing at every turn. There's this kind of contrast between the way their experience of the night is going on, and that she has this amazing time to do all these fun and interesting things, while whatever he seems to blunder into goes horribly wrong.
It's a very good film. I would argue when it comes to it that I prefer this over Lou Over the Wall, but it is a really good fun film. It's quite an interesting way to put it as well, considering that when you look at the male lead senpai, he is essentially just stalking her,
Yeah,
which is
yeah.
quite something. But it is very well done. And there's a lot of crazy things going on, both the way that the film is captured in its animation, which is done all in flash. I don't know how you really put it. It's just a good amount of fun with the way the film's done and the just experiencing her nightlife and how everyone's kind of connected in that way.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of a strange one, and it seems to have been quite divisive. I mean, I think some people have really related to this one and really enjoyed it, whereas others have been left a little bit cold by it, which kind of interested me. I mean, I don't know whether it's because there is the slightly seedy aspect of Senpai's quest, or I don't know. I'm not quite sure why it is that people have not all responded to this, and I don't know whether maybe it just depends how much you can empathize with the kind of things that the characters are going through, or.
Whilst it is about their journey to kind of find each other, there's so many stories that interlink with what's happening and so much that goes on that so many other stories get a resolution as you go on and before anything else happened. And it's fun seeing those characters because whilst they are the main characters, they are a little bit bland in some ways because they feel more like a device to see how everyone else reacts, essentially, how everyone else is doing their thing. And you've got the Don Underwear, as he's called, trying to find the love of his life. You have the other best friend of Senpai, who is a guy that dresses up as a girl to lure in people to do his work for him. Then you've got the other characters that Kohai meets as she goes on her journey, both when she's drinking and whatever else, who kind of, you then see their story kind of expand out at the same time. It's a joy to see that happen more than it is to see what happens with the two main
Yeah.
characters. which seems a bit weird. You'd think, oh, that's not really good for a film. But I think, honestly, with the way the film is done, it works really well because they work as a catalyst for the rest of the story.
It's quite a densely packed narrative. I don't know if that's maybe what maybe people found it a little difficult to follow, but maybe one of the problems you could accuse it of is that the structure of it seems a little odd. The second act builds into these elaborate musical numbers going on, but then that seems to end, and then the film continues for another section after that. In a kind of way, it feels like the musical numbers ought to come at the end.
Yeah, it feels like a film of four acts, essentially. You've got your first act, which is the drinking. You've got the second one, which is all about books and such. Third bit, then suddenly turns the film into a musical, which is maybe a bit misplaced, but it's a joy to watch. You've got the fourth act after, which kind of connects everything together and finishes it all up for you. I can see what you mean with the kind of musical side of things being maybe something better for the end, but there's a part of me that feels like it was well-placed to lap up the rest of the stories. So maybe in some ways it did finish up everything at that point for everyone else, but then it just had the story for the two main characters coming to a conclusion in the fourth act afterwards. So maybe it's a good way to kind of view the musical note as a conclusion for everyone else, but then you've just got the main conclusion to get from there on.
Possibly, yeah. I don't know. I enjoyed the film a lot. Possibly not more than the Tamiya Galaxy, but I think it was a worthy kind of follow-up to that. I don't think it hurts the brand of that, the adaptations of that author's work.
No, I mean, I for one haven't seen Tatami Galaxy yet, so I went into this as my first work of theirs and Yuasa's as well, so I hadn't really seen, I've not seen Kick Heart, I've not seen Mind Game, and that's why we haven't mentioned Mind Game here as well. Whilst it was shown, I never went to see it either. But this and what we're coming up to next in the moment is the only things I've seen of his work, so it is, I think they're all treated as a trilogy of the films together, but it does make me want to watch the Tamiya Galaxy and see where the connections lie.
Well,
I think
it's much easier to do now that it's ended up on Crunchyroll, so
yeah, so it'd be worth watching there, and if you're the same, then you can always watch it there now as well.
Yes, subscribe to Crunchyroll, kids.
We do not get any profit from doing so.
No.
So don't subscribe. If you subscribe, please tell Crunchyroll to give us a sponsorship, please.
Yes.
No, that's right, don't worry.
don't worry, we won't become the next Miles or anything. On that note, Lou Over the Wall. I didn't get to see this one either, although I'm hoping to catch this when I think it goes on wider release next month.
Yeah.
How did you find this one? I mean, this was, again, something that I don't think did all that well in Japan.
No, so just to kind of give a brief synopsis for the film where I can, the film revolves around this middle schooler in this town, which name actually means like they've given up, and he's kind of given up in his life, he's down, he's not feeling great, and it's basically him encountering this mermaid or merfolk, and his life kind of just opens up, and he starts to understand what life really has to offer, and then hilarity ensues from there. I enjoyed it, and I think whilst I liked Yuasa's Night is Short more than this, the animation on through this, again, it was done through Flash, was far more interesting, far more amazing to see with some of the scenes. The film itself very much feels like Yuasa's taking from Ponyo and adapted it to himself, it's his own work, because it very much feels like you're watching another iteration of Ponyo. There is a lot of similarities between the way the mermaid works, the way she interacts with the main character and everyone else. There's a lot of similarities to the way Ponyo is in that. But it's a heartwarming story for all ages. It was a really good amount of fun. There was a lot of humour in the film, a lot of family-friendly motifs in there as well. There was still something about it, regardless of that, that I didn't find as good as some of the other outings. The music was fun because it was a lot. There was a lot of focus on music in the film, which I feel like is actually a fairly decent motif for a lot of stuff this year. Because the first time they encounter the mermaid, it's all about they're kind of playing like a band on this island, which is formerly called, I think, Merfolk Island. And as they suddenly go through doing their song, the mermaid starts singing. The one thing, and I kid you not, it does sound like this: is when she sings, it sounds like you're listening to a song from Splatoon. It's quite the thing. She sounds like a Splatoon character singing, and it does sound like that. But it's, I don't know. I think it was really nice. I can understand why it's won the award for audience and for the judges award at the event. But I just don't feel it was for me. I think there was something off about the film in my eyes that I just can't put my fingers on.
Do you think it's trying to play to too broad an audience, maybe?
The thing is, the film itself was supposedly aimed at teens and above rather than all ages. But the film itself very much feels like it's got something for everyone. So there's something there for the kids to enjoy. There was shown at the event itself, we had, where I was sitting, there was a family with their kids actually watching the film as well. Admittedly, when they were watching the film, they realised that it's playing subtitles, so they said, oops, but the kids still seem to be able to enjoy the film regardless. It's definitely a film that would benefit with a larger showing dubbed, because kids will definitely enjoy the film for what it is.
Yeah.
But there's still something that I wasn't as entertained on with. There is a bit for everything. There's a bit of humour there, here, there, and everywhere with everything. I just feel like it's either done something that I've seen before too often. There's a, I guess, an element of Ponyo in there, Ghibli in there, but there's also a bit of maybe some, I almost want to say Disney-esque styles to it as well, which I think I've seen a lot of times, and whilst it's nice to see it the way it's done, and don't get me wrong, the animation is gorgeous, especially with it being done through Flash, they had a lot of room to play with. I just feel like something in the story itself and the way it's, and just what I saw just didn't enthrall me as I think it should have done.
I was a little dubious about this one after having seen the trailer for it originally. I didn't feel all that enthused by this to the extent that I did for Night is Short. But Yuasa was in attendance for Q&A after the premiere screening of Night is Short, and I remember while I was there, he did say, please go and see Lou Over the Wall. And, you know, when you're there with the director saying, please go and see our film, it's, you do feel, yeah, I should probably go and check that out.
I should probably go see it, yeah. I mean, so yeah, just to finish off with that, with Lou Over the Wall, I think it's definitely a film you should watch. There's definitely something there for everyone. Whilst I may not have enjoyed the film to the same extent everyone else did, because it is still a really, really good film, and it does deserve the awards it got. I think Night is Short could have won it if it was on the awards, but it's a good film at the end of the day, honestly.
Yeah, no, I quite look forward to seeing this when it goes on general release, and having said that several times now, I feel like I've cursed it, and it won't go on general release. So.
You're almost as repetitive as Eureka 7 was, though.
Yeah.
Joy.
Yeah, I think that takes us through everything, so if you've made it this far into the podcast, congratulations, and I don't know, maybe we should just apologise. But you know,
I'm so
do,
sorry.
If you do happen to have any comments, questions, ASCII art drawings of middle finger, then...
At @NakamaB_podcast.
Just give us a tweet to what Arbalest just said. Or give us a comment on the AUKN forum. There is a well-marked mega thread for the podcast in the anime chit chat section, or there will be an episode specific thread in the news and rumors section, so feel free to leave us any hate mail, animation gifs, whatever, etc. there. And failing that, we will hopefully see you next time, as much as we can see anything through a purely audio based medium.
We shall definitely see you then, and if anything else happens, you can always send us a direct message on the forums now as well, so you can always do that. Or, of course, as we always say, you can always contact us via Carrier Pigeon. Just throw it and it'll know where it's going.
They always know.
They always know.